Welcome to Smart Water Solutions Podcast. I'm Hakim Elfadil. This is episode number 71. Today, Riafe Beki is joining me to host Professor Brett Bryan from Deakin University. In this episode, we're going to cover two points: ecosystem service flows and water sustainability. Ecosystem services are nature's way of helping us. They are the thing like clean air from forests, bees pollinating plants so we can have fruits, and rivers providing us fresh water. It's all about how nature supports us or supports our life. And water sustainability is about using water carefully. We need to make sure there is enough for everyone today and for people in the future. Even as the climate changes and more people live on Earth, it's about being smart with our water use so to keep the planet healthy. So before jumping to those two points, Professor Bryan, would you like to introduce yourself and give us an idea how you become professor on global change, environment and society?
Well, yes, okay, thanks, Ria. As you mentioned, I'm a professor at Deakin University in Melbourne, Australia. And I've been here now for 6 years. I haven't always been an academic. So before that, I was a principal research scientist and a policy analyst and major project leader in CSIRO, Land and Water Division. So CSIRO is Australia's national science agency, and I was part of a policy and economic research unit. So I'm a geographer by background and training, and an environmental and spatial modeler. So I work with numbers and data and try and develop solutions across the environment and ecosystems. And I was moved from the University of Adelaide to CSIRO and landed in this group of what was largely economists. And so we spent 14 years developing, trying to understand each other's language and developing a really strong integrated assessment capability that looked at water and environmental and human issues in largely in Australia, but also internationally and globally. And so what we would do there is work with clients who were normally government and sometimes private industry to assess different issues and trajectories and trends and anticipate problems and come up with solutions on how to manage sustainability issues in the environment, particularly to help people manage things like water resources, but also agriculture, land, water quality and quantity and biodiversity a lot better than we have in the past.
You know, I was wondering when you mentioned that to understand the language between each other, that's a very good point. I feel that also, even in the same field, when as Ria mentioned, when we transition from academia to the industry, I feel sometimes it's different language, although we mean the same thing. So I would like, if you just briefly touch this point, so how important that economists and then scientists and environmentalists to have like common ground language. How is this valuable for us really to solve this problem?
Yeah, look, it's the most important thing, I think. And part of my role as a geographer, you know, I was trained as a generalist at a university in undergrad, in masters, and even my PhD was always sort of generalist, large scale, integrated problems that looked at multiple different types of environmental issues and human management. And that was largely human economic activities that were causing environmental issues. So to manage all these things, you need specialists, you need economists, you need hydrologists, ecologists, mathematicians, programmers, geographers, but more importantly, they need to be able to work together to each bring their own perspective to the problem. And to work together, you need to be able to speak the same language. And that doesn't happen instantly. There's there are a few opportunities to train as a generalist across different types of, the economics, environment, geography, hydrology. It's not often that you come across people that can integrate naturally. You have to sort of work with people and understand how they think and understand the basic concepts. And even for me, it took us as a group years for me to understand things like supply and demand curves and how they worked and how they influenced price. And that's basic economics 101. But for the economists, it was very difficult for them to understand spatial processes and change over space and the interaction of different social and economic and environmental processes. So, and it's only when you sort of embed yourself in a group with a common problem to solve that. And the people have to be the right fit that, you enjoy working together, you enjoy working outside of your comfort zone and enjoy constantly learning, because you're never an expert. You're always, asking the dumbest of questions, and it's only by doing that you learn to apply these interdisciplinary concepts to solve these hard problems. Because I mean, these problems are not just hard, they're wicked. So for some, and what I mean by that is for many of the problems, there are no solutions, there are no obvious solutions. Any solution you apply has trade-offs and may have perverse outcomes. So your solution might actually make the problem worse. And so it's the only way to approach these wicked problems in society and the environment.
Yeah, and one thing I also I learned is when I interacted with those people from different backgrounds, is it teach me sometimes how to frame the question properly, because sometimes I frame the question is not really meaningful, but interacting with them, then I reframe it in a really meaningful way. And this is bringing me to the question, which is the first one, the ecosystem service. So knowing that you have been working with different disciplines, so what does mean ecosystem service for scientists and economists and environmentalists, I think?
Ecosystem services is a classic concept. It's been around since the 90s, or probably earlier, but it became popular in the late 90s when Bob Costanza and others valued the nature's benefits to people of the environment of the planet Earth. And the answer was $33 trillion. Dollars, like an enormous amount of money. That was the value that nature opposed, or the benefits that people got in dollar terms from a healthy global environment. And that just spurred a huge amount of activity, research and management, and using this concept of ecosystem services to put a value on nature. And so nature has benefits for people. We might enjoy a nice view. We might enjoy going camping or hiking in a natural area, swimming in clean, fresh water on nice, clean beaches. And of course, we all need to drink clean water and eat food, which are products of the environment. And these benefits are hard to put into dollar terms, and we don't think about them in the balance sheets of corporations. But ecosystem services divides up the benefits that people get from nature and the well-being benefits that we get from nature into things like provisioning services, food, water, clean air, and so on, regulating services, supporting services, which are things like soil and basic physical, biophysical processes, and cultural services, things like, as I mentioned, recreation, but also scientific benefits, education, spiritual benefits, and a sense of place and things like that. So the whole range of benefits that people get from nature. And for water in particular, water ecosystems and fresh water are crucial ecosystem services. So humans get a whole range of benefits from healthy and clean supplies of fresh water, both for human consumption, of course, fundamentally, but industry, and also a range of cultural benefits that we get from things like rivers and clean water sources.
Is it then also an indirect way of protecting nature? If we put a direct value on nature, is it an indirect way of protecting it?
Well, that's the idea. Yeah, once we can put a value on nature and natural capital, which is the kind of the sister concept to ecosystem services, once we can get a dollar value, then corporations, governments, even households can start to understand the value of a healthy environment and a healthy waterways, healthy forests, healthy atmosphere, and then would start to bring that into the balance sheets, not just a profit and loss statement, but if we start to include the impacts of what we call externalities, or economists call externalities, which are the costs of polluting the environment or having an environmental impact. Usually those externalities no one pays for, because the actual costs aren't accrued to companies' balance sheets. But if we start to bring that in through natural capital accounting, and there's really advanced methods that we can use now that have been developed by the United Nations, and such as a system of environmental and economic accounting, we can start to put dollar terms on the environment and the benefits people get from the environment. And then if a company does, or a government or individuals do damage the environment, then we can start to use that information about the cost in policy. So we can start to bring in economic incentives, such as taxes or incentives, positive incentives to provide a motivation for those organizations to not pollute, to clean up the environment, and to innovate and come up with other ways to do things like dispose of waste, or basically motivates organizations to have less of an impact on the environment.
And so then you, by reading your work, you often divide different capital. So you have natural capital, then build human capital, and then the beneficiaries. So is this how you then interrelate, for example, people with nature? And when you're speaking about the beneficiaries, do you sometimes also look at nature as a beneficiary? Because it looks like it's always in... with regard to humans that we're talking about beneficiaries, but on the long term, it might also be important to have nature as a beneficiary.
I think you're referring to our work on water-related ecosystem service flows, mm-hmm. there, that led by Jingyu Lin, Lexi Lin. So it's always been the case where the benefits and for well-being that humans derive from the environment, it's not just a product of natural capital and ecosystem services, but we also combine natural capital with a whole range of other capitals, such as built and human capital, financial capital, and social capital. So without these other forms of capital, we wouldn't get the same amount of benefit for our well-being. An example there is wastewater treatment plants, of course. So we can get a benefit from fresh water from a nearby river or a lake system where humans can take off water, they can irrigate crops, we can use it in their houses and our industries and our manufacturing. And usually what happens is that we then pollute that water either by a sewage, we pollute it through industry, through agricultural runoff and agrochemicals. And then that goes back into the environment, which then gets cleaned up by the environment. The chemicals settle out in the environment. They just through natural processes, the water gets cleaned up, and that provision of fresh water is a product of the environment. But we also help that process by building water treatment plants. We don't take water straight out of a river and pump it into households. We run it through a water treatment plant to clean it up and get rid of any remaining nasties, so the population doesn't get sick from microbiota and so on. But we also clean up the water on the other side, on the brown side. So where wastewater, we have wastewater treatment plants. So before putting it straight back into the environment, whether that's a lake or a river, we typically treat that water, get rid of the nutrients as far as possible, get rid of the sludge, and put it in a much cleaner state than it was back into the environment. So we're sort of combining, we're helping out the ecosystem on both the taking water out of the environment for consumption and then putting polluted water back into the environment. So technology and infrastructure and built capital there is really essential on all sides of that water cycle of natural and human use. And the beneficiaries are typically referred to as people. So, you know, we're people in households and industry and farms, irrigators, for example, benefit. They get water from the environment. And we do things with that. We produce, we manufacture goods, we provide services, we grow crops and livestock and so on with that water. And that's part of the benefits that comes to people from the environment. We typically don't talk about the environment as a beneficiary so much. It's more about people and people's well-being.
And I'm just wondering here the pressure that is done on the water ecosystem, knowing that, as you said at the beginning, sitting with the economists, there should be growth every year. And what does mean for me, if there is a growth every year, it means also in agriculture sector, then you need to grow more crops. It doesn't mean always necessary to increase the water consumption, but I just would like to have your thoughts on this point, how the ecosystem, the water ecosystem stress has been handled while the economy is growing every year.
Yeah, I mean, this is a classic debate between economists and ecologists. So economists, you know, they want to see the economy grow by a certain percentage. Typically in Australia, we have a target growth of between 2 and 3% per year. And so anyone that's half decent at maths can put that into Excel. And if you have something that grows between 2 and 3% per year, eventually you get a very steep rate of growth and a very steep rate of increase in consumption of natural resources to produce food, goods, services for humanity. How and why does that happen? Well, population increases every year. Well, it is for the foreseeable future, for the rest of this century anyway. And each one of us is consuming more. So we consume more clothes, more food, more meat, and so on. And so that rate of consumption, that exponentially increasing rate of consumption, is unfathomable to ecologists who deal with a limitation on the Earth's resources. So there are finite resources on the planet, finite amounts of fresh water, finite amounts of land, finite amounts of almost every natural resource you can think of: nitrogen, phosphorus, fossil fuels. We can't just keep, and the great tension here is that how do we keep increasing our consumption exponentially of these finite resources? And so this is the great debate about how do we continue to grow whilst decoupling our consumption of the Earth's natural resources, and therefore decouple humanity's impact on the environment. And we can start to see that happening with the energy system, where if we can transition from fossil fuels to more renewable sources, then we have a much less of a limitation on incoming energy sources than we do currently. But for things like water, there is a limited amount of fresh water. Now, we might argue that if we can use renewable energy to desalinate, there you go, Hakim, that's in your your area of expertise. We can desalinate endless amounts of water. Well, maybe that is the case, and we might be able to do that. But at the moment, we're still struggling with this compounding increase in consumption of natural resources that are indeed finite. And there's been some great work on what's called the planetary boundaries. So there are these are defined global limits on biophysical resources and the environment, and then there are things like the limits on the amount of CO2 we can put into the atmosphere, limits on the amount of fresh water that we can use, limits on the amount of nitrogen and phosphorus that we can pump into the environment, and a range of others. And so this tension that you speak about is real, and one that we deal with on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I can imagine also the mining industry, because it's really broad in Australia. And then sometimes you have the acid mine drainage, which is partially by human and partially by nature itself. So, and then at the end, I think human need to treat it, even though it's by nature is done. You have a huge stream of acid mine drainage. And this brings me to the question is, as you mentioned, nitrogen, for example, there's a metal, heavy metals. So which criteria, I mean, why you choose certain parameters and then you kind of not suppress, not neglect, but you kind of prioritize some parameters like nitrogen, phosphor, and then the others are not in the top priority?
That's a good question. I think we follow the science. So, we look at international papers such as the planetary boundaries work that identifies these specific boundaries that are key boundaries. And that's not, it's not an exhaustive list. But we have to start somewhere. You know, 20 years ago, we were just looking at single indicators of environmental performance. Maybe it was water availability or environmental flows. And then we would bring in, well, we would understand that, okay, well, there are trade-offs in these complex environmental systems. So if we're looking at agriculture and water offtake for irrigation, for example, we take water out of the environment and we use it to grow crops. Okay, great. We can increase the amount of food. We can feed more people. We can export food and improve the livelihoods of the world's population. That's great, but we're also taking water out of that system, reducing environmental flows, reducing the amount of flooding required for key species in rivers, for trees in the floodplains. We're changing the hydrology of entire river systems, and a lot of our work has been focused on the Murray-Darling Basin, particularly the Lower Murray, where a lot of that has played out. So we've got changed environmental flows, less frequent, less extensive floods, and the near collapse of floodplain ecosystems and riparian ecosystems in Australia's major waterway. So these trade-offs govern most of our work. So we started off with a single indicator. We start to bring in, well, you know, we're doing well in producing food. We're doing, it has a trade-off, reducing the amount of water. So then we have an ecological impact. Maybe if we start to bring in climate change and the need to address climate change, well, that then has another compounding effect, where one of the best ways that we know to take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere is to grow trees. And if we plant the right trees in the right places, well, then we can also start to repair the biodiversity and ecosystems that have been damaged by the clearance of agriculture. And so we can start to repair ecosystems. However, we also know that trees use a lot more water than cereal crops or pastures. And so if we start to fix one problem, climate change, by planting trees, we start to compound another problem, which is a lack of water and environmental flows in rivers. And so you start to build up, once you start looking at more and more indicators, you start to build up a much better picture of the complex system that it occurs in nature, but also how humans impact that complex system. And we try and quantify the synergies or the co-benefits, things that work well. So we can plant trees and we can take carbon out of the atmosphere and we can improve biodiversity, but also the trade-offs. So, okay, we can plant trees and fix biodiversity and carbon, but we use more water. So once we understand those, we can start to build models of those, which give us a quantitative idea of the relative effects of planting trees in different areas. And then we can start to use clever mathematics such as optimization to say, all right, well, where are the best places, the most efficient places to plant trees, so that we're not impinging on our ability to produce food, and so we're having the best impact for the climate, the best impact for the biodiversity, and we're minimizing our impact on water resources. And by putting all these data sets together and all these models together, we can start to inform planning and zoning and regulation and policy. We can start to inform incentive policies which motivate private landholders and farmers to plant trees or do other pro-environmental actions on their properties. to do things like nature-based solutions to improve carbon in soils, to do things like use less agrochemicals or organic or regenerative agriculture, a whole range of different solutions that are available. And these models, as we work through and we understand more, we can build in more complexity and start to better target these planning and zoning and areas and these incentive policies that we can design that can very surgically target the right actions in the right places to make the place better rather than mess it up anymore.
For which period you do this model? I mean, the benefits or the disadvantage, is it for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years or short period?
Yeah, so we do some historical work, so historical assessment, things like recent land use change in Australia. We've looked at since 1985. We've done a lot of work in China, and most of their dynamics starts to happen since 2000 onwards. But the most important work, I think, is to look into the future. Now, we very often use 2030 as a time horizon, and that's mainly because of the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, which has a horizon of 2030. So every member country of the United Nations has signed up to these amazing 17 Sustainable Development Goals, and under those 17 goals, there's 160 odd targets and over 200 indicators of where we want to be. It's our shared aspiration of where we want to be as a planet. And there's a range of social goals, environmental goals, economic goals, and covering many different aspects of society and the environment. So 2030 is an important date for us, and a lot of our work. A key goal in there is SDG 6, which is clean water and sanitation. So that looks at people's right to have access and the ability to have access to clean water, fresh water. And so it also gives us a framework where we're not only looking at water, but we can bring in these other elements of sustainability, like food provision and hunger, sustainable cities and communities, climate action, life on land, life below water. The SDGs gives us a great framework with which to work. And we do studies assessing the likelihood of whether we're actually going to be able to achieve the SDGs or how close we can get. And as I've been talking about so far, there's often trade-offs involved. So we've found that it's actually quite difficult to achieve the SDGs. Well, most of our work has been in Australia and China, but also globally because of these trade-offs. And it really matters the specifics of what you do where and when in order to better manage the environment really matters in trying to get closer to more of the SDGs. Having said that, 2030 is important, but we also look longer term. So 2050, which gives us a nice mid-century horizon, a bit more of a chance for policies to work. And also 2100 is a key date as well, because that's where most of the climate models go out to. We've got good population models that go out to 2100, and a lot of the climate impacts are much more severe and play out much more over that longer time horizon. By 2030, we're not seeing anywhere near that end of century climate impact of some of the more severe climate scenarios. So we do try and take a bit of a shorter term, mid-range and a longer term view, and these coincide with the key policy milestone dates, not just the SDGs, but things like a net zero commitment by 2050 under the Paris Agreement and other other key policy targets.
But because you said it's important to look into the future, but how does it actually go with respect to the uncertainty of the future? Because it's, of course, we have the models and we have some data, some predictions, but what do we do with the uncertainty on the predictions, actually? How do you incorporate that uncertainty into your models? And how accurate are the models then?
That's a great question. And we know that the models are always simplifications of what's going on in the real world, and they're not going to be perfectly accurate. But we also deal with what we call deep uncertainty. So deep uncertainty is that we just have no idea which way something's going to go. So a policy decision or a human, usually that's associated with human decisions, whether humanity is going to meet the Paris Agreement or whether Paris Agreement is going to become even more stringent, and let's say we meet it by 2035. Or anyway, there's these deep uncertainties which we can't know, and then there's also these sort of known uncertainties, which are things around the model variability. So what we do is we run many model runs into the future, taking random draws from the distributions of all these uncertain parameters. And so we end up with many thousands of model runs and scenario outputs. And then we can look at these cloud, if you like, of scenario outputs and say, all right, well, we're interested in this portion of the output cloud over in this area, which meets our SDGs or meets the Paris Agreement or whatever target is that you're interested in. And then we can look at those scenario outputs and say, what parameter inputs and policy decisions and model choices are required in order to get us there? This is called scenario discovery, really smart technique that came out of the RAND Corporation. And so then we can say, okay, well, here's our safe operating space, if you like. We know that these scenario parameters get us to where we want to be. They meet our targets, given this huge range of uncertainty that we're dealing with. And so we know that, for example, we might need a carbon price between $100 and $150 a ton. We might need a water price for irrigators between $70 and $100 of water delivery price, or $1,000, $1,500 of water license price. We need a policy on land use change to avoid these certain areas or to limit the expansion of livestock farming, to limit deforestation or whatever it might be. We know that we might need an X amount of reforestation in order to dial our atmospheric CO2 levels back a bit. So that process of running many model scenarios with these draws from the uncertainty bands of the key parameters, and then choosing the ones that meet our targets, and then looking at those and saying, what do we need in order to get there? That's the process that we typically deal with uncertainty. And you know, that uncertainty is very not crippling, but very significant. And by doing this process, we come up with what we call robust solutions. So these are solutions or settings that we know will work no matter what the future holds. And so that's what we strive to achieve, these robust solutions which work no matter what unfolds.
That's very interesting. And are you then still hopeful for these solutions? Do you think that these robust solutions that you've just talked about, that we will be able to implement those?
There are, I think we've got a small window of solutions and combinations of solutions that will get us to a place which comes close to the SDGs, to keeping climate change within, below a dangerous level, keeping our key water ecosystems alive. But it's a very specific combination of solutions that govern agriculture, that govern water use and water treatment, water quality, things like agrochemical use and nutrient use efficiency, and limiting the runoff of nutrients into waterways, taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere through things like reforestation, but also in the rest of the economy. It's important that we do things that limit future damage, limit CO2 emissions and methane emissions, that improve energy use efficiency, that transition to renewables. So we really can't afford not to do any of the solutions that we know will work, and we can't afford not to do them at scale if we're going to achieve that small and ever closing window that's still open to us at the moment.
Now, zooming into those silos, I would say that you put in your model, if we look to water sustainability, and I think maybe is your focus area is Australia and China, if I'm correct. So where do we stand currently, and then which kind of actions, you undertaking in those regions to maintain this water sustainability?
Yeah, two very different countries with very different issues, but I guess Australia, to start with, even in the media today, there was a story came out that Australia was behind in delivery of the Murray-Darling Basin plans. The Murray-Darling Basin covers 12% of Australia's land area, most of its agricultural production. Large cities are dependent on the fresh water. It's our key river system. There are other big rivers, but it is the biggest. And it's largely a problem with agricultural over-extraction of water for agricultural irrigation. The Murray-Darling Plan was put in place under legislation to deal with that, and to claw water back from irrigators, to buy water back from irrigators for the environment. And that just came out today that it was behind and needs to catch up in order to meet targets, I think behind by about 750 gigalitres. About how much water is required to be given back to the environment. And obviously it's a highly contested resource, just in that area, billions of dollars of agricultural production are at stake. So highly contested and highly politicized issue. But the Murray-Darling Basin Plan can get us at least a good part of the way there. So I think in the first instance, we need to get that back on track, and then work towards, all right, well, what's the next thing in the Murray-Darling Basin Plan review and so on. Other parts of Australia, we've got to deal with drought again. We're just coming out of three La Nina years, three wet years, and maybe coming into a drier period. So it's not that long ago we had the Millennium Drought in the late 90s and 2000s. So we need to start thinking about drought again in the near future, and how, you know, we've got more people, bigger cities, higher demand for water now than we had previously, and that needs to become at the forefront of science and policy again. It's hard to think about drought when you've got floods occurring, which is what we've had for the past 3 years. But for China, China's a very different set of water issues, and it's split almost in two. So in the north, we've got issues of drought in the Yellow River Basin, but also things like erosion and sedimentation. And in the Yangtze in the south, we've got floods and catastrophic floods that can devastate cities with populations of millions of people. So we've got the dry north and the wet south, and China's actually put in place huge environmental programs to deal with things like erosion and sedimentation, programs like the Grain for Green program and the Three North Shelter Belt, programs that deal with improving agricultural production and water use efficiency and land consolidation, making farms more productive and more efficient and less polluting. They've spent over $378 billion since the 1980s on environmental and agricultural programs. So it's a major, major focus in China to manage things like floods and droughts and erosion. The Yellow River, before these programs, spewed out of its mouth about 2 billion tons of sediment per year. These are eroded, fine, loess soils from the Loess Plateau out of the mouth of the Yellow River. And these programs of revegetation and stabilizing hillsides have virtually turned that level of sedimentation back to historically low levels. And so they've had an impact. Things like Three Gorges Dam, very controversial, involved moving it, migrating about over a million people out of the reservoir area, but the reservoir manages the flooding of the downstream Yangtze. It provides renewable energy for millions of people, and we've done work there to look at the impacts of rehabilitation on that area and the streams coming into the Three Gorges Dam, and they're showing signs of ecological recovery of fish species, recovery in terms of the chemical and biological content of the water flowing into the reservoir and those sorts of things. So that's positive. There are very many issues still left in China to deal with, particularly around water pollution, soil pollution, mainly from industry, but also its very large agriculture, piggeries and livestock production in particular. So another thing we're working on is wastewater treatment plants in China. So China have just brought in really stringent new water quality standards for outflows from wastewater treatment, so sewage treatment works. And so we're calculating using life cycle assessment, life cycle cost assessment, what the environmental costs and benefits would be of upgrading China's fleet of over 8,000 wastewater treatment plants, and what the costs will be. And this looks right from the upstream production of materials, energy use, concrete and all sorts of things, right through to the wastewater stream and the quality of the water that comes out of those treatment plants. And we can design upgrade pathways for this fleet of plants that in order to have the greatest environmental benefit at the lowest cost, in order to allow them to meet these standards. So That's some exciting work with Chinese colleagues. That we're focusing on at the moment.
In your work, we found very interesting one of the topics that you covered also ecosystem flowing beyond national boundaries. And would you just, walk us how you quantify and how you map this? And specifically, we're talking about water ecosystem flowing beyond national boundaries.
Do you mean the virtual water flows?
Yes.
The water that's embodied in products?
Yeah.
So some work we did led by my PhD student, Abdullah Sheikh. Abdullah's work quantified global flows of trade of agricultural products and the water that's embodied in those products, and it's a strange term, but it's essentially the water used to produce those products. So and we talk about the trade of those products being the flow of virtual water between countries. So when one country produce, such as Australia, produces a lot of agricultural products for export, so about 60 plus percent of Australia's agricultural production is produced for export. A lot of those products, we've used water, blue water, water extracted from rivers and lakes to irrigate those products. And then we export that. So we say that, well, Australia is exporting virtual water to other countries. And so this is a way for the world's population to trade essential goods and services like food, but what's hidden in those products is this water use. So we've looked at the water scarcity of countries, every country in the world, and we can quantify the water scarcity, and we can then look at what is it the water used in agricultural production in that country. And what is how much of that water is being used to produce products that are then traded to other countries? We then can flip that on its head and look at, well, what is the shared responsibility here for water resource use? It's not just the problem of the producer country. So let's say, Australia's water scarce and we most of our agriculture goes offshore for other countries. It's also the responsibility of those trading partners to look at their supply chain and go, all right, well, are we using products that embody a lot of water? Do those products come from water scarce countries? And are we contributing to the problem of water scarcity in those countries? And we can look at particular supply chains. So it might be the US, for example, contributes quite a bit to the water scarcity of other countries because it imports a lot of food from water scarce countries. And so we can look at, all right, well, what are the actual products? Is it wheat? Is it rice? And where are they being produced that's having the most impact on the water scarcity, exacerbating the water scarcity of these producer companies? And then that information can then be used to underpin trade agreements, to underpin shared bilateral programs that can do things like share water-saving technology to transfer know-how and science from one country to another to improve the water use efficiency in that supply chain to reduce the impact on that producer company country. So in that way, we look at this shared concept of shared responsibility. We don't just put it on the producer country. It's a shared problem and needs a shared solution.
It's very interesting, this shared responsibility. Also, when looking into the future, I think this will become even more important. Just when you were talking about earlier about China and Australia, even then those countries, the water a situation is very different, even in one country, it can be very different, as you mentioned, for China. So how are we going to deal with all those different countries that we have? And because the situation is so specific. So do you then think that we need to investigate all the countries individually and then see how they interact with each other? Because, and then on what you said in the next question, the interaction is also very important with respect to virtual water, but also how the water streams are interconnecting different countries. So there's like a global interaction, but at the same time, the local environment is very different. So how do you relate those two?
Yeah, I think it's a matter of detailed work. I mean, we simply, when it comes to water, one rule can't fit everybody. So with greenhouse gas emissions, it's different. You know, a ton of greenhouse gas emissions emitted in Australia, in Europe, in China, whatever, has the same impact, no matter where it's emitted. But with water, it's very contextual. So it very much depends on the environment and the hydrology and the climate of the local area, even the socioeconomic status and the local culture of the access to technology and so on of the local areas. And so we've got to, I mean, there's no way around the fact that we've got to look at the nuance of local social ecological systems, and that involves looking at across and building our general understanding of how the environment relates with people in each one of those countries, and as you mentioned, even at that sub-national level, it's important. And a lot of our work is spatial, so it's we don't look at countries as a whole. We look at individual grid cells, and because as we know, even within catchments and between catchments, we have a great deal of environmental heterogeneity. The environment's very locally contextualized. So we try and look at these issues in as high a spatial resolution as we can, the finest level of spatial granularity, because it's almost always the case that these targeted solutions are often the best. And if we look at these one size fits all solutions, we're almost doomed to failure.
Yeah, my last question would be because in some of your articles, I think you mentioned also that small lakes also influence global water and also and trends and carbon emission, I would say. So it's somehow it's the impact of water is also impacting the carbon emissions, is also the it's a matter
Hakeem,
for
sorry.
Climate change.
I missed about 20 seconds there. Could you please repeat the question?
Okay. In one of your articles, also you covered the impact of small lakes on global water trends and carbon emission. So would you just walk us how it's important to pay attention to the small lakes and how it's influencing the global climate change?
Yes, this follows on from that last point we were talking about, where this very high resolution information comes to the fore. So previously, we have global lake data sets, but this work used a satellite that's called Landsat, which is a 30 meter. It divides the planet up into 30 meter by 30 meter grid cells or pixels. So this enabled us, and once we'd mapped global lakes over time, we were able to identify lakes that were much smaller than had previously been mapped in other data sets, because we were using a much higher resolution satellite product. And so looking at the dynamics of these lakes, which expanded and contracted much more regularly, much more frequently than larger lakes, which had implications for the carbon dynamics and the emissions from those lakes. So although I think these small lakes were only 15% of the global lake area. They had an outsized effect on the carbon emissions from lake dynamics. And so, yeah, just another example of how sort of high resolution, nuanced geographical understandings are just so important to come up with management solutions. And so we can now say, well, all right, well, let's, if we were to focus on small lakes, what is it that we would do? These are things like farm dams, often managed by local landholders or local communities. You know, how can we then work with local communities in understanding how the dynamics of their water management can actually add up to quite a large effect an outsized effect on global climate change? And so this approach of working with stakeholders it is something we've done over the years as well, and certainly increased our focus on how to develop solutions with local people. So if solutions and problems affect local people, then we need to involve those people in designing ways to fix them. And we use this process called co-design or knowledge co-production. And we try and involve stakeholders and local communities and local business holders and farmers in the science right from the start. Now, whilst we didn't do that in the global study, it's a bit hard to incorporate people when you're working at that scale. When we're working at the local scale, at local catchments and local communities, that's been a real focus of it. And this transdisciplinary science, not just interdisciplinary, but transdisciplinary. That's when you work with multiple different scientists and the stakeholders who are involved. And we find that these transdisciplinary approaches of knowledge co-production are just absolutely essential in designing solutions that work, because we have the buy-in, the understanding, the shared understanding, and the co-learning. So we learn from local people and they learn from us. And together we can come up with something that works.
I have one last question for you. I think it's quite closely related to what you just said. So, we've talked about transdisciplinary, interdisciplinary, all the different stakeholders. It's such a complex story, very difficult to investigate, to do research on. And so I'm wondering if you can think of any parameter or any aspect that is really important in your field, but that doesn't get enough attention. If you understood my question, so can you come up, or have you encountered yourself in your research something that is actually really important that should be investigated more, but that is currently not present in the models, or that is not even by policymakers, is not incorporated in the policies? So just something you can think of that deserves more attention than it currently gets.
Look, I think more and more as we work. I've gone through a career of building increasingly sophisticated, complex models, using large data sets and enormous computers, and coming up with fantastic graphs and uncertainty bands and numbers and percentages and this and that. I wonder whether I often wonder whether I'm presenting that to policymakers, whether I'm presenting the results of this wonderful science that we've done. Is that really cutting through? And I think that there are better approaches that we need to develop to communicate the outputs of our science, our water science and our environmental science in general. In order to, communicate and have policymakers and communities understand what's going on, because it's so complex. the last, we've got different interactions, we've got co-benefits and trade-offs and time, non-linear changes over time and perverse outcomes and things. It's so complex and such wicked problems that the last thing we need to do is further confuse everybody with these complex scientific presentations and numerical outputs and so on. So what we're trialing now is an approach called story listening or storytelling, where we're taking the results of a complex systems model of a local irrigation area called Goulburn Murray Irrigation District. And we've built a very, very complex model. Rehana Bhandari, my PhD students, built this amazing model integrating agriculture, land use, the economy, labor, education, housing, tourism, all this stuff. Magnificent stuff. But in order to communicate that to our local stakeholders, we just don't think these complex graphs will work. So what we're doing is building a narrative using a story about two families in the region and how their lives will be affected under these two different scenarios and the choices that they can make. And one makes one choice and another makes another choice. And how education can help one of the family members get a job in the agricultural sector, and the water availability will change in such a way, and climate will come in and have this effect on their farm business or their dairy farm. And so it's a much more real and genuine and sort of natural human approach to communicating the results of these complex models. And I think that's going to be a real winner. So I'm very excited about how that will go.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We look forward to hearing your stories.
My pleasure.